The next case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Vanden Pretty Weasel. Ellery Gray appears on behalf of the appellant and will be arguing, and Aaron Hanke appears on behalf of the appellee and will be arguing. Each side will have 15 minutes, and then there'll be a five-minute rebuttal. Mr. Gray, you may proceed, Mr. Gray.
Good morning. Thank you for your recognition, counsel. I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Pretty Weasel to ask this court to consider reversing the conviction in this matter, remanding the matter back to circuit court with instructions that a new trial take place. The grounds for our request today are twofold. First, it's our position that at the trial we were surprised by the prosecution by an expert witness who gave expert opinions that were not disclosed. And second, and related, even if we had received proper notice of those opinions, the opinions that were presented would not have met muster under the rules of evidence or under the Supreme Court precedent that controls those types of opinions. Now, briefly, by way of a factual background, Mr. Pretty Weasel was living in a blended home, and he was accused by his stepdaughter, who was 12 years old at the time, of inappropriate touching that she alleged occurred in the home. By way of additional background, she had also previously accused a step-sibling, another minor child, of having done similar things. The family was then going to counseling to address the allegations of the step-sibling. It was the defense theory at trial that there was no physical evidence of any touching between Mr. Pretty Weasel and his stepdaughter, that the family was being hypervigilant because they were already in counseling involving the allegations related to the step-sibling. So, for example, open-door policies and that type of thing. It was also our position that Mr. Pretty Weasel was very active in taking his stepdaughter to these counseling sessions, and that if he had been doing something like that, that would be a pretty brazen act on his part. And in addition, we also allege that there was motive on the part of the stepdaughter to fabricate these allegations. In counseling, she admitted that she was angry with Mr. Pretty Weasel because she had been spanked. Now, the state took the position that there were several text messages that Mr. Pretty Weasel sent after discovering about the allegations. We could call those the apology text messages. And then, of course, there was also a pretext phone call. Now, this was not a confession to law enforcement, but there were statements made by Mr. Pretty Weasel on the phone to his wife where he admitted to some touching having occurred. It was the defense position that the only reason he made those statements was because he was trying to repair the relationship with his wife. And apparently, at least to some extent, it must have worked because the couple were, again, physically intimate on several occasions after he made these statements. So it's in that context that we then come to the error that we're complaining of here today. It was on the last day of trial. The state brought in a witness who was not on the witness list and brought in the counselor of the alleged victim. The counselor then started to give expert opinions. After the state laid the foundation of her background, what she did as a counselor, and that she was treating the alleged victim in this matter, the prosecution asked about, well, why does the alleged victim always want to be dirty? I'm paraphrasing to an extent here. What does that mean in your profession? And the counselor went on to explain, well, because she doesn't want to be perpetrated on, she thinks that if she stays ugly or if she stays smelly, that's going to keep people from doing this to her. The state then also went on to ask, well, what's your diagnosis of the person that you're treating? The expert's response was, well, she's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. It's our position that the jury could very easily infer that the counselor is really putting her stamp of approval on the testimony of the alleged victim in this context.
So that the fact that she had been diagnosed with PTSD had already come into the record through the mother's testimony, didn't it?
I think that's correct.
So that wasn't a new piece of information for the jury?
I would say that it is, because previously you have the mother who's not a counselor, she's testifying, she's talking about things. Now we have the actual counselor on the stand after having laid the foundation. So the expert the counselor, that testimony is going to, I would argue, carry much more weight, especially in the context of how the examination of the expert occurred.
But she didn't really give much beyond that, did she? I mean, then it was an explanation of what post-traumatic stress disorder is, but then you objected and the court sustained any further testimony as it relates to specifically, you know, what would have been the precipitator of that. So, you know, how is that in the end, the impact of that much different than what was already in the record?
So the position that I would make is one that's very similar to the argument that was made or what this court found in State versus Buckles. You have an expert who's on the stand, who's testifying with, I think the court wrote to a certain extent, an air of medical certainty here. You have an expert that's giving that diagnosis. So there's that, we can call it the halo effect coming from the expert. But it's in this context of a child sexual assault case where the expert's now telling the jury, after laying in the foundation of her background, that she's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's so, I'm sorry, can I jump in?
I was done.
Thank you. You made me feel slightly better for interrupting, but I appreciate it. That's where I wanted to go. Is it really in that context? I understand your Buchholz argument, and I understand the objection you made about it. It's being overruled, and the diagnosis testimony comes in. But it almost seems as though the specter of Mr. Prettyweasel's involvement as an actor, a criminal actor, doesn't enter the picture until redirect. And that testimony about the diagnosis comes in on direct. And what precedes it is, it seems to be focused on the abuse by the step-sibling. So your answer to Justice Finney is exactly my thought. Is the context a sexual assault? Maybe a sexual assault, but is it a sexual assault by Mr. Prettyweasel when the diagnosis testimony comes in? And is that really matter? But I suppose as a follow-on, but it seemed like the context was really set with the step-sibling, and then that connection testimony came in on redirect when the specter of Mr. Prettyweasel as an actor kind of comes in.
So we'll have to read the cold record, I suppose, and try to figure out how this works. The important thing, I think, to keep in mind is this is Mr. Prettyweasel's trial. The state has called this witness for a reason, to try to get a conviction against this particular defendant.
But isn't the context of how that happened also important? I mean, the reason that the state calls Hughes is because there's been a subpoena of records, and the records show up essentially on the morning of trial, as I understand it.
That's correct.
And this is all kind of happening on the fly, correct?
It is. Well, I'm sorry, please.
No, go ahead. No, you explain. I mean, it is happening on the fly. You are all trying to figure out exactly how this new evidence is going to be presented to the jury, if at all. And you're making motions, and the judge is dealing with them as they come up. And some of them, the judge stops and says, no, you can't go that far. Some of them, the judge allows.
So, and I want to make sure I'm answering your question. We've got the prejudice issue. Of course, there's additional opinions beyond the ones we've already addressed, including the expert talking about what it means when the alleged victim says, I'm mad at my father. Now, is the state, should they get maybe a break, so to speak, because things are coming in on the fly? And my answer is no. Under State versus Blem, the state has these records on the first day of trial. If they decide that they're going to bring in expert opinions, they should be announcing that before they put their witness on. And that's why I discuss the Kaiser factors and everything. I understand that the state might say, well, things have changed. But under the rules of discovery, they shouldn't be putting their witness on and then having those expert opinions come out for the first time.
So this case seems to be a little bit different in the sense that it was through your cross-examination of the mom that some of this information about her going to a counselor started. So there are specific questions asked about her going to see this counselor and what she told the counselor.
That's correct.
So this seems to be more of a situation in that respect as far as what was said. And I understand your argument, some of what then she later testified to the counselor in response to the state's questions might have delved into areas of expert opinion. But in fairness, when you're just asking, when you bring it up in terms of a cross question to the mother, wouldn't that allow the state at least to treat her almost as a fact witness and respond to some of that or get into that? So this wasn't like the expert hadn't even been mentioned. You brought the expert up initially. And with the understanding, I understand your arguments that maybe it went a little further than lay witness testimony when she actually testified. But maybe you could address that. Doesn't that give it a little bit different backdrop here?
I don't think so, and here's the reason why. On the defense, we've got the alleged victim. There's no physical evidence. Her credibility is going to be paramount. I think we have the right to challenge that credibility and ask about facts from other witnesses. So I'll certainly concede that if there's other facts that the state thinks need to be brought up, the state might say, well, look, we didn't know those facts were going to be brought up. Here's a fact witness. But is asking a witness about facts, does that then open the door to surprise expert testimony? And the reason, I hope that's answering the court's question.
Well, you know, specifically the question about did she tell Hughes that she didn't like Pretty Weasel because he's your father, because he spanked her. Okay, so that came in through your cross.
That's correct.
So wouldn't it be fair then, in response to that, to call the counselor to give some context as to that statement?
You mean in a factual setting?
Right.
So we could ask the counselor, is it true? Did the alleged victim come in? Did she state these words? Did she state other things?
Well, to lay the context, because if you just pull one line out, but if you don't explain, you know, what was being discussed, that wouldn't that be when she made that statement? Wouldn't that be fair game?
Not to bring in an expert opinion to refute that. I don't think that under the rules, me asking a fact question then permits the state to ignore the rules of discovery and say, well, now we're entitled to bring in an expert opinion. Now, if that were the case, the state under State versus Blem should have announced that beforehand so that way we could have perhaps a Daubert challenge or we could then prepare to meet that testimony. So Hughes isn't just merely providing the context of that discussion. She comes back and she explains that children are compartmental thinkers, and the fact that the child says this here, well, that doesn't have any relation to anything over here. That's an expert opinion. That's not a lay opinion providing context. That's something I should have known about, so that way I would have been able to challenge that. I don't know if that's correct or not. I didn't have a chance to consult with my own experts to see about that or to bring in an expert to counter that testimony. I certainly was not advised by the state that type of evidence might be coming up if I simply asked the question about what was said at counseling.
Mr. Gray, I want you to assume for a minute they all were improper opinions. I'm sure you're happy to do that. I want to move to prejudice. And you're arguing these Kaiser factors, which come out of a civil case, and it's a little bit different. It's, the issue, the opinions went to the heart of the issue. They were crucial, you know, those sorts of analysis versus our traditional analysis in a criminal case probably would have made a difference in the outcome. Assume for a minute that that's the prejudice we apply, traditional prejudice. Tell me why those opinions, in your view, were prejudicial in the sense of probably would have made a difference in the outcome of the case.
So under a Chapman harmless error standard, or using this court's analysis in Buckles, the court said we had improper opinions, and you looked at two things. One, the court said, well, because these are expert opinions, they're going to carry some weight with the jury. The opinions didn't simply tell the jury how to interpret evidence in Buckles. The court was concerned that these opinions about the veracity of the witness could be viewed as independent evidence. The second thing that this court was concerned with in Buckles is the court said, well, look, we also have this opinion goes to the heart of the matter. In Buckles, there was a defense about whether the child was confused in a child sex case. Here, these opinions go to the veracity or how to interpret the motive that we said that the alleged victim had to fabricate. So we're meeting those Buckles standards, but then we have something in addition, and that comes to those Kaiser factors. Presumably in Buckles, those opinions were disclosed and the defense was prepared to challenge. Here, unlike in Buckles, where the court found error, We didn't have that chance to know what those were. I'm sitting there having to cross-examine this witness, and I don't know, you know, the old adage, don't ask a question on cross-examination you don't know the answer to. I don't know what the answers are because we don't have a report.
But again, that goes to error. That goes to the, you know, assuming there was error, there's error there. So and I get your argument is, hey, I should have been able to present this evidence. But in the context of the jury found your client guilty, what about those opinions would have made a difference in that ultimate verdict?
I see my time is up.
Did you answer it?
The problem is we have a conviction, but those expert opinions were not fully confronted under the cross-examination clause of the Sixth Amendment. Defense counsel was unprepared because he did not know about those opinions. So now I'm in a spot of saying I don't know what I would have asked because I didn't have a chance to prepare and be fully prepped for it, much like the parties in Kaiser where we had the issue of causation. They're getting these opinions on the fly. And so the Kaiser factors really, I think, also address prejudice. Goes to the heart of the issue. They're not fully confronted.
Thank you. Ms. Hanke, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. The circuit court properly allowed AD's counselor Deborah Hughes' testimony at trial. Pretty Weasel had motioned the circuit court for a subpoena for AD's counseling records. Over the prosecution's objection, the circuit court granted the order. A little over 6 months later, the circuit court signed the subpoena duces tecum for these records. Hughes returned the records to the court essentially the weekend before trial. The court reviewed those records in camera and disseminated them to the parties Monday morning, first day of trial.
Does the fact that they were subpoenaed by one party or the other, or that they were disclosed, or that they were disclosed when they were disclosed, does that matter in any way, shape, or form to the evidentiary issues that we have in this case? And I'll zero you in on exactly what I'm talking about, because when you got to the point where you had the diagnosis question, what's the diagnosis?
Mm-hmm.
And the objection, Mr. Gray, is objection 702 and Buckles, so ruling and then the voucher rule from Buckles. Overruled, the court says, because you requested, these have been subpoenaed at your request and both parties have them, I'm going to allow it. Why would that matter?
I think it certainly puts defense counsel on notice that these records exist.
But it's not responsive to 702 or Buckles, is it? That was the objection.
Right, Your Honor. And I know these records, this witness was not disclosed under 702. But I don't think, I think the circuit court was getting at, counsel, you knew these records were coming, you weren't completely caught off guard, and I know, I don't believe it was part of judge's ruling.
So that would maybe make the disclosure rule, but how about the Buchholz rule? What's the diagnosis? That kind of sounds a lot like Buchholz.
I think you can distinguish Buchholz in this case, though, Your Honor. In Buchholz, the diagnosis of the child was child sexual abuse. And in this instance, AD's diagnosis was PTSD. And there was a lot of information coming at the jury through trial of the abuse that AD endured. And specifically, Hughes' testimony really focused on the abuse she suffered at the hands of her step-sibling. And we also heard that maybe she's upset with Pretty Weasel because he had spanked her. And so there's a lot of information coming in there. We don't know the root of the PTSD diagnosis. It's kind of this elusive, it's out there, but it's not, it doesn't go to the heart of the issue, which was, did Pretty Weasel sexually abuse AD?
If we were to conclude that the context was such that it was offered at Pretty Weasel's trial,
mm-hmm.
and that somehow mattered, would this case be all that different from Buchholz in the sense that the voucher rule from Buchholz says the expert can't tell the jury based upon and cloaked with their expert designation what happened? Is that a concern here? What's your diagnosis, post-traumatic stress disorder? What does that mean? Someone had a traumatic event. That happened.
And she did have a traumatic event, She had several traumatic events, to be completely honest. But again, Hughes' testimony was, up until that point, focused on the sexual abuse by the step-sibling.
I saw that.
And so there's a lot, like, there's a lot of information going on there where I don't know what her PTSD diagnosis comes from. I mean, the jury doesn't either. And so just because you have that PTSD diagnosis doesn't necessarily mean we're vouching for her credibility, saying, yes, she was sexually abused by Pretty Weasel in this case.
Okay. That seems to go to this, to the argument that we shouldn't be doing these things on the fly. Mr. Ellery or Mr. Gray suggests that once the state decided that they were going to need to call Hughes as a witness, that they should have disclosed that to the defense, and then presumably some other procedure would have happened besides trying it on the fly. Whether that, I don't know exactly what that would have been. What are your thoughts about that? Did the state make a mistake by not saying to Mr. Gray outside the presence of the jury, oh, by the way, we're going to call Hughes and we're going to ask her questions about these things, and if you have a problem with that, let's deal with it with the judge outside the presence of the jury so we don't have the problems that we have here today?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, and you asked a lot of questions, so I'll... But disclosure, the earlier the better, absolutely. I don't know when the prosecutor decided to call Hughes as a witness. Clearly from her testimony, it was kind of on the fly. I think Mr. Gray had asked her a question if she had much time to prep, and she said, no, I just barely got here, or something along the lines. Obviously, we want to disclose that stuff because we don't want to be blindsided by anything. That's evidence should not be first presented at trial. But there are instances where things do happen, and in this instance, you know, defense counsel never, when this prosecution called for Hughes as a witness, there wasn't, you know, recess, Your Honor, hey, what's going on here, state, can we get some clarification, can I voir dire this witness, can I figure out what's going on? There wasn't even that initial surprise, and I recognize that Mr. Gray did object to certain questions throughout, but when Hughes was initially called as a witness, there was no objection to her testimony.
So, counsel, assume, for purposes of argument, that she was an expert, that her opinions weren't timely disclosed. I'd like to hear your response to Mr. Gray's argument that his client's been prejudiced, in part because he was unable to fully develop his cross-examination.
Certainly, Your Honor. I don't think defense meets the prejudice prong. Hughes did testify to a decent amount of information, the PTSD diagnosis, where she kind of, AD is changing her appearance to make herself less desirable, things like that. But this was not new evidence that the court or the jury heard. This evidence also came in through, I believe, AD's mother, as Justice Devaney had pointed out earlier. And so this was not new information for the jury to hear?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think, you know, she gave an opinion of post-traumatic stress disorder, and then the state says, what does that mean? And the counselor goes on and says, that's an event where an individual fears being harmed or the harm of someone else. What's the relevance of that except guess who's harming me? I mean, so it was more than just this is post-traumatic stress disorder. This is an explanation from an expert, an opinion, saying this was caused by someone harming her.
Right, and we still don't know who, at this point, from Hughes' perspective, we do not know who was harming A.D. She testified that the
right,
step-sibling
the
was harming.
It completely fits into the state's case of the person harming her is Mr. Pretty Weasel.
It could be interpreted that way. It could also be interpreted that the step-sibling did it. Or maybe Pretty Weasel spanked her and she was upset and it was so traumatic it caused PTSD.
I interrupted. I think
oh, that's okay.
Justice Kern,
I apologize. I forget where I was at in my thought there. There was. Oh, yes. Aside from Chief Justice's disagreement with a lot of this information that Hughes has testified to already came in through other avenues throughout the court, there was also significant evidence to support his guilty conviction. AD testified herself and went into very detailed descriptions of the abuse she endured at the hands of AD, and I do not think Pretty Weasel was prejudiced by Hughes' testimony at trial.
There were admissions as well.
I'm sorry, what was
there? There were admissions.
Yes, there was admissions. AD's biological father and mother both testified to some changes in her behavior. She had an experience with her father a couple years ago that kind of raised some alarms for possible abuse as well. So, if the court has no further questions, the state would respectfully request the court to affirm Pretty Weasel's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gray, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you. The issue that concerns me the most is, as practitioners, as we're getting ready for these trials, we do pretrial discovery, we file requests under the rules to make sure that we know what the expert opinions are. That gives us a chance then to be fully prepared at trial on behalf of our clients. We know what those opinions are going to be. We can consult with experts. That's frequently done, so we can either have help preparing for the cross-examination or perhaps bringing in counter-experts. When the rules of procedure break down, the adversarial process breaks down. When there's a surprise witness, we're caught flat-footed on whichever side. And I think...
Did you consider requesting the opportunity to void error the witness in advance, as just suggested by opposing counsel? Ask for a short break in the trial, ring the witness in outside the presence, and conduct a void error.
So I'll answer your question in two ways. One, I subjectively considered it while on the stand. I realize I'm testifying. That is not in the record because I made the strategic decision to not do that. Not knowing, will this be a mere fact witness? Is she going to testify to a record? Is she going to say, well, here's the day that we sat down and this is what she said and nothing else was mentioned? Well, I suppose I could have objected to those facts, but I figured that would be coming in and that might actually help the defense. Where I became alarmed and started to then vigorously object was when we started going into expert opinions. And then, so getting back to the court's other concern, well, what about prejudice? Okay, so it's error under the rules of discovery to not disclose these opinions. Well, how is that prejudicial? Well, it's prejudicial because we did not have the chance to fully prepare. If you read my cross-examination, it's very short because I don't know what the answers to her questions are going to be. For example, I could say, so you're telling us, ma'am, that you can tell by listening to a child what she's saying back on such and such a date. You can tell us with an expert opinion that that's completely unrelated to allegations that she makes months later, that the anger has nothing to do with this. Now, I suppose I could be cute and say, well, do you have any medical journals to back that up, or what's your basis for that opinion? Well, I could be surprised, and she might say, well, yes, I have it here. I didn't know what those answers were going to be.
I understand that, and I don't want to keep beating prejudice to death, but I really think that's really your key issue in this case. So let's assume you had a full opportunity, you had those opinions disclosed. Well, in any event, let's say you had an opportunity to cross-examine, develop, and basically completely refuted the opinions given by the expert. What difference would that have made in the case?
And let's assume I can even bring my own super expert in. And
yeah. Right.
So here's then the prejudice. The jury's going to have to make the credibility call on whether they believe that expert or not.
Go ahead, please.
So then we come back to the Buckles decision. If the jury finds those expert opinions to be credible, it goes to the veracity of the witness, and it also undermines one of the key elements of our defense because she's saying, hey, jury, when she's saying she's angry at her dad, don't be confused by that. That has nothing to do with her later allegations. It does not give her motive to fabricate. So we have the same elements here that we would have had in Buckles.
Well, let's say you'd be even better. And your 702 objection, which you make twice, is interpreted by the court to implicate Daubert, which I think would be fair. And you send the jury out, and you have an impromptu Daubert hearing, and you win. Evidence isn't relevant. It's not reliable. The opinions that she would offer don't make it in the exercise of the court's gatekeeping role. So you don't need another expert. She doesn't testify. If that scenario unfolds, how does that impact the prejudice analysis?
So I want to make...
Maybe it doesn't change your answer a lick from what you told the chief, but I'm curious. So she doesn't testify at all. Those opinions, they don't come in. you're successful in keeping them out under 702 in Del Bear. They just don't come in. The diagnosis stuff, the connection, the compartmentalization, they don't come in.
So I'll answer that two ways. First, you're correct. If I would have said, hey, Judge, I want a sidebar, I want a Daubert challenge, and I had won that, yeah, we wouldn't be here on those issues because the jury would not have heard those. Does that answer your question? So then the next follow-up would be, well, was that my obligation under Rule 103, I believe, that lays out what I need to do to give the court notice of what the objection is? And so the state in State versus Blemid made arguments, well, hey, defense counsel really needs to ask for a Daubert challenge. They should really be bringing this up as soon as the witness takes the stand. That's not what this court found in Blem. And so if there's a different standard, then apparently I failed my client because I thought I was meeting 103.
I was just curious. My question, if I could continue, Chief.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I'm not critical in the least, just curious about how that affects, and poor question, not necessarily the prejudice, but the quantum of evidence in the record. If she doesn't testify, does that fundamentally change what's already in the record?
I want to make sure I understand. If we're going to apply the harmless error standard, this isn't the witness is testifying to five different areas of expertise and accidentally or even purposefully stumbled into one small sub-area. If we're going to do a harmless error analysis, we have to essentially take all of Hughes's testimony out of the record. The evidence is very significant. This isn't just one minor opinion. It's multiple opinions, which our position go to the heart of the defense and the veracity of the alleged victim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both counsel for your arguments this morning. And the case is fully submitted. We'll be in recess till tomorrow morning. Thank you.